You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in our region and beyond. Today we are going to talk about diving, and we're going to be discussing how archival documents were used to solve a nearly 70-year-old mystery. My guest, Archer Mayo, diver and amateur investigator, joins us to discuss his years-long effort to crack the case of the Martin family disappearance. Archer, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much, Chelsea. Really glad to be here.
Yeah, so let's start out with a very brief overview of the case. In December of 1958, Kenneth and Barbara Martin, along with their three daughters, left Portland to get Christmas greenery to make wreaths, and they never returned. Two of the daughters were recovered in the Columbia River less than a year later, but the fate of the rest of the family has remained a mystery until very recently. So, Archer, what was your introduction to this famous Oregon cold case? How did you get involved?
Well, it's a good question. You know, I lived in Australia, did an artist residency in Western Australia on the Indian Ocean, and I got really into free diving and artifacts. You know, there's a lot of Dutch shipwrecks there from the spice trade, and there's a whole museum dedicated to that. And I really fell in love with this idea of story and how stories can be truncated and lost, like in shipwrecks. And so I came back to the Columbia, where I I live in Washington, White Salmon, Washington. And I saw the river really differently. This was in like 2011, 2012. And I was like, wow, this is an interesting river, not just for the surface and for the wind, but the fact that people have lived here for 15 or 18,000 years and no one really has explored it. So I kind of set out at that point to start free diving and scuba diving. And then I started finding mysteries and solving those mysteries. And eventually, you know, people give you more mysteries. When you solve things, people start emailing you other things. And so, the Martin family one, Jeff Gianola had done a special and somebody had seen that and forwarded that to me. And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting one.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's the short story.
And to go from diving in the sea to the river, I mean, we just spent some time in Astoria this summer as part of our field school and went to the Maritime Museum and learned about, you know, how dangerous, you know, that's the graveyard of the sea over there. But people think about shipwrecks, but not like cars and stuff. But how deep is the river in, you know, in this area where you're working?
Yeah, well, where I'm working is a man-made, in the early 1870s, the federal government started carving a canal through basically a peninsula that was to bypass a set of waterfalls called the Cascades, right? The mountains are named after this. But generally, like through Portland area, the river is like between, I'd say 30 to 65 feet is kind of on average. And the same above the Cascades. There is one place where it's 200 feet in the Dalles where the river's basically turned on its side because of rock ledges. But for the most part, it's, I'd say 30 to 60 feet. And that's where I was working. I was working at about 55 feet in this man-made navigation canal.
Okay, I'm still processing 200 feet there. Like, that is so much water to fill,
right?
You know, oh my gosh. Okay, I guess, yeah, I just never thought about it being that deep. That's insane. And, you know, when we talk about the Martin family, you know, you said you've been solving other mysteries and stuff. Like, a car is a pretty big thing to look for. And it had been searched, you know, this area had been searched so many times. So, you know, what made you think that you would have something new to offer this? Just you were spending a lot of time underwater and getting to know the area?
Yeah, well, so these are navigation locks, right? So like I said, in 1870, they started digging this canal, and the canal went through a peninsula of land. The idea was, before that, there was a portage railroad. So a boat would show up from Portland, it would dock, everything would have to be offloaded, all the people, then they would have to wait for another boat on the what was called the Mid-Columbia section to come and get them and then take them to the next waterfall, which was Celilo Falls in the Downs. So the federal government said, we're going to build a canal so everything will be free and there won't be this. There was really very high monopolistic fees based on that portage railroad. So, you know, the federal government recognized that, like, all the wheat harvests that were in eastern Oregon and all the development of the Northwest was being choked basically by this portage railroad monopoly. So they set out to build this, and it is all in stone. It's hand-built. They brought all these stonemasons in from both Europe and the East Coast, and So I knew that they had suspected maybe Cascade Locks was a place, because it's one of the only places where a car could drive right to the edge of the river. Mostly in the 50s and still today, there's a railroad that is almost always between you and the river if you're in a car.
So
I thought, well, this, I know they didn't find a car here, but maybe there's a complication here that I can figure out of why a car wouldn't be found. That was kind of the premise.
So
I started diving. Fortunately, about this time, these battery-powered scooters or diver propulsion devices, which is something I kind of hold on to, and it pulls me through the water. So it allows me to basically negate the current, because the current's very dangerous, especially in a canal. There's old fish nets, there's industrial waste, there's parts of the old canal, there's tunnels. There's things that can easily take your life as a diver.
Because they're just floating there down against you, just like all the stuff's kind of coming down river underground or underwater?
No, it's lodged in place for the most part, but I without a scooter, I'm powerless to not get washed into it.
Oh, and then trapped potentially or something.
Yeah, entrapment, yeah. Right? Entrapment's a big thing. And there's tunnels. There's miles of tunnels under the canal that some of them suck and some of them are blowing out water and you just don't know what's in there and you do not want to go in, right? Because no one was ever going to know what happened to you.
Yeah.
So I started exploring. Once I had a scooter, which is battery powered, I started exploring the canal and I realized that so much of the canal is still there, these giant iron doors, and because it was a set of locks. And what you could raise a steamboat up about 20 feet, depending on the time of year, to let it pass the falls. And so, but there was one place that really bothered me, which was like it goes from a concrete floor, and all of a sudden there's this section of basically sand and rocks that's slightly depressed, and then it goes back to concrete at one point. I'm like, well, why? What is that? And there was no as-built plans that anyone knew about at the museum. There's a local museum in Cascade Locks, which is a great little museum, but not very well resourced and not very big. And they don't even have plans for how the canal was built at that point. So I thought, well, what is this feature? Why does the bottom drop away? And why is, it's full of stuff, obviously. It's basically 100% full. So I took a fiberglass rod, like a 15-foot rod, and I drove it down next to the concrete, and it just kept going and going and going. And I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. So that's a feature. For some reason, there's a deep section that is now completely full.
Yeah.
And that's like, it's like the compartment in the bottom of a magician's top hat. So something could be, and that's where I thought.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. And today we are speaking with a citizen detective that used archives to solve a famous cold case. So you realize there's this really deep, weird, sandy thing. You strike out at the local museum. So what do you dive into next, if not the Columbia River?
Yeah, well, the museum had no plans for how they actually built this. And so, this canal has been basically lost to history. But somebody mentioned, I think maybe someone who was mowing the grass there at the thing, he said, I think the Army Corps of Engineers might have given a box of photos to the Oregon Historical Society. And it was just like on top of his brain. Like, I think there's a box floating around. And I'm like, I have to track down that box.
Yeah!
So I went to the Oregon Historical Society, which is such a beautiful. They have a research library upstairs, and it's like being in a treehouse. It's gorgeous. There's these north-facing windows and trees outside and beautiful oak tables, and they were able to locate the box. And basically,
wow,
these itinerant photographers would travel through the Northwest periodically, like every couple of years, and they would document these federal projects. And at one point, there's so many pictures of when they first started. It's kind of like when you have your first child, you take so many pictures, right? But by the middle child, you're not taking that much. So that was the same with the canal. And the feature I'm looking for was basically right in the middle of the canal. And they started at one end and built the whole thing kind of linearly. So it was hard to find, but I ended up finding a picture of this deep pit, 20 feet deep, 90 feet across and 45 feet across as the current goes. So about 83,000 cubic feet of emptiness on the bottom of the river. And I thought, I know it's full now, but what was it in the late 1950s? If it was only half full, that means the car is about halfway down in this debris stack.
Yeah. And you're probably like one of the only people around that would recognize that for what it is, because you'd already spent that time down there and being like, something really weird is happening right here. Most other people would be like, oh, they're just building the thing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And like I said, there's only one picture of this pit or two
wow.
pictures of it. So it's, and you have to really understand, like, what is the purpose? You have to know what you're looking at, because often these pictures are not big panoramas of the whole context. They're close-ups of technical things. So, and I've always been really interested in civil engineering. My grandfather was kind of a famous tunnel builder in worked in the New York subway systems and a lot of, like, the tunnel before when it was being planned. So the way my dad would show love was take me on hikes to civil engineering things. And so I naturally want to understand what I'm seeing.
Yeah. And, I listened to some podcasts about this case when I heard there was some new updates. And when I heard the Oregon Historical Connection, I was like, oh, my gosh, I've got to talk to him. This is so amazing to use these kind of archives. Because when people collect these kind of documents, you don't always know, that's the point of curating them, is you don't know what they could be useful for in the future. So I'm sure whoever found that box of pictures and took it over to the Historical Society for safekeeping had no idea that you would come along to, like, make these connections.
Right. I mean, I thought a fantasy headline is, man sees 121-year-old picture and solves 70-year-old mystery.
That's amazing. Yes, that can be the title of this episode. So, when you say you saw, just for people like me who don't have engineering brains and stuff, when you say you saw the empty hole, like, so did they build, like, a cofferdam around this, or is it literally, like, where's the water?
No, that's a good point. So there's a kind of a peninsula, like a half-round peninsula, and they didn't rupture the end, so the river still goes around this peninsula, and they started like 100 yards in digging, and then they dug out the whole middle section, and they kept, or a couple hundred feet anyway, of dam to keep the river out of both the top and the bottom of the canal. And once it was fully ready, they cut that dirt away and let the water flow through. So basically, they were going through it was a peninsula that was formed by a massive landslide. There's an older history here of a huge landslide that slid from the Oregon side of the river way up onto the Washington, or up from the Washington side, sorry, to the Oregon side. And that's what caused the Bridge of the Gods. It actually closed the Columbia River for some amount of time, and the river rose up hundreds of feet and eventually breached it. And then the remains of that landslide, the pieces of rock and stone that were too big for the river to move became the Cascades. Like, that's why that waterfall was there. It was not like a ledge waterfall. It was a series of giant rocks that just held up the river, basically.
That's amazing. And so you probably don't know this detail, but my archaeology mind wants to know, what did they do with the sediment that they removed from the river? Did they, like, pile it on the banks on the side?
Yeah, right. And so because it was landslide debris, it was very unorganized. There's no bedrock. And that's the reason this pit exists, which was really interesting, because they were building in basically very poor conditions soil-wise, because it was a landslide. They would use that to then armor the outside along the waterfall, because the river back then, there was no Bonneville Dam. There was no dam. So the river could be really out of control in the spring, and it could rise up 20, 30, 40 feet. And so they used a lot of that debris. They tried to use as much stone as they could for the actual blocks of building the canal. And then the rest of it, they kind of piled up to build a little bit of a dam around this this construction project. And it took them 20 years to build this. And they took a 6-year break when they realized they miscalculated the approaches. Because no one knew, or no Europeans understood how high the river got or how low the river got, because they were just looking at a decade or so of knowledge.
Yeah.
And so once they figured out that the river can actually get really, really low, then steamships couldn't even make it to the locks they were building without doing some alterations of the lower river parts, blasting rocks out.
Yeah. So you have this aha moment. You realize the car is probably in this pit. Like, yeah. what do you do next? Like, because like you said, it's filled just with sediment over time. Like, how do you look under? I mean, you're doing underwater archaeology at this point.
Oh, completely. And then, so a car is about 300, a big 50s car is about 360 cubic feet. This pit is 83,000 cubic feet. So there could be 225 cars without even poking up into the bottom of the canal. Like, that's how big the pit is. So my chances... And I went to the Army Corps of Engineers with the photo, and I went to the sheriff, and I'm like, hey, I think I know where this is. I need some permits. But I realized, like, I can't empty the whole thing. But my permit was just for a very small amount of this material. So I really had to come up with a hypothesis of where the car was going to be.
And we're going to take a quick break before you tell us where it is. And we'll be back with more Underground History. And we're back, and you're listening to Underground History. I'm Chelsea Rose. Today, I'm joined by Archer Mayo, and he's about to tell us how he finds the car in the bottom of the Cascades in this big pit. So, okay, sorry to interrupt.
Well, so here's the interesting thing. It wasn't the only car. There was three cars down there. One was pretty recent. It was a pickup truck that had been stolen in Portland and dumped. And that was something I knew kind of from the beginning. It was like this half-buried car. Then I found a part of a Volkswagen Bug, which might be related to the Ted Bundy murders, but they weren't able to prove it one way or the other. But it's the same make and model as someone who went missing. So the fact that there was two cars down there, and they both ended up at the very back of the pit, meaning a car coming into the pit doesn't just fall off the edge and go straight down. It has so much energy by the spring thaws that knock things into the pit that it crashes against the very back wall. If you can imagine that. So, you know, because if in May and June, the river, all the snow melt is going through the Columbia system. So the river generally picks up about four times the current in those 2 months. And so a car that had just fallen into the canal, which is what I believe happened, they drove into the canal accidentally. The car sat relatively close to where the accident happened for December, January, February, March, April. And then May, the car starts rolling because the water is really swollen now, picking up. Two of the girls floated out, and the car goes all the way until it crashes into the pit.
Uh-huh.
So the energy with which these things arrive into the pit, because the energy of the river is tremendous, so I thought, well, after understanding this, I realized, well, it's going to be on the back wall someplace. But the back wall is 90 feet long, so how do I choose where to dig? And then the girls had been seen, actually, in May of 59, about 25 feet off the bank by a fisherman. And I thought, if the car was rolling, the girls floated out, they would float along the line of the current. So that's my best bet, is 30 feet off the shore and then on the back wall. That's my X and Y coordinates. So that's where I started digging. And that's 2 years later.
Wow.
That's where the car was.
And literally digging, because you can't use a metal detector because there's other metal down there. So you're literally like moving. And I mean, how do you dig underwater? Isn't the dirt
right.
just like
so
go everywhere?
I had to build a suction dredge.
Like a dredge. Oh.
Yeah. So it's on the boat. So there's a boat anchored up in with one of my assistants on it who's in the canal, like along the side of the canal. And there's this big high pressure pump and it pumps water down, and then the water is used to move. It creates a suction, basically, and then it pumps the water out of the pit and a little bit down current. So all the debris, the rocks, anything that fits into that 5-inch tube can get sucked out, and it just nicely goes down current where I'm not messing with the visibility issues and all the fogging.
And so, like you said, you had to get a bunch of permits and stuff. Like, you cannot just go do this in the river without having to think about, like, fish or whatever. I don't know, like, sediments
fish,
and all
Indian
that stuff.
Artifacts,
yeah.
Funerary stuff, the uh-huh. Oregon historical, you know, I can't remember the name of it now, but the archaeologists basically of the state, the Department of Natural Resources, all the Indian tribes. I mean, getting the permissions was one of the hardest parts of this whole project. And I see why. I mean, they had to have like 120 different sign-offs
yeah.
from different commissions to allow this to happen. But, you know, it really helps when a lot of the people who work in these agencies are like 35-year-old women who really like true crime. So all I had to do was tell them I'm trying to solve the Martin mystery, and I had their full attention.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the State Historic Preservation Office is who you would have had to go
SHPO.
Through, too. Yeah,
yeah,
SHPO. And so we work with them all the time, too, because, yeah, there is. I mean, the same things that have brought, you know, these kind of artifacts from the 20th century down there, of course, there's stuff from, you know, hundreds and thousands of years of occupation in this area. So, you know, you're suctioning stuff out. I mean, this has got to be dangerous too. I mean, it's not only challenging, but you know, what's the safety thing as you're moving dirt out and creating a void? Isn't that unstable for like collapse and for something to shift and like whack you?
Yeah, right. And I mean, there's so much anthropogenic stuff down there. There's tires, there's things. So, and when you dig underwater, you know, like rocks are relatively light because of the density of the water around them. So things like angle of repose is everything. It's like digging in a gravel pile. like you're never going to make a very deep shaft by digging a hole because there's water in them, around them. Everything is lightened by the density differences. Like when I'm digging in the bottom, I'm actually just moving stuff in the bottom and the collapse moves up a hill, basically. So when I'm digging in the bottom, I'm actually watching the sides of this big cone that I'm digging, you know, this big shape. And that's where I see something coming out of the hill is not at the bottom, but it's in the sides, right? Because everything's falling down all the time, which means the water's getting, like, the visibility often goes down to nil. And then the other thing I really had to understand was the history of the floods. In 1894, there was the biggest one ever known. Then in 1948, the one that ruined Vanport in Portland. But that was all pre the car missing. But the ones after the car were significant. 64, 65, and 96 were major floods that I really had to, you know, I'm looking for certain types of material. Those floods that had different signatures.
You were totally being an archaeologist.
If I had to do my whole life again, I would be a marine archaeologist.
Yeah. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. And today we are talking about how a photo in the Oregon Historical Society helped crack a 70-year-old cold case. So you're looking for what we would call in the archaeology business stratigraphy. So the kind of sediment that you would expect to see from this era. You know, you're like older or younger based on what flood event. So that is super interesting. And so then you kind of know where you are in time. And then you start to see a car?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I knew 64, so they went missing in 58. They were buried in the pit in 59 during the spring thaw. And then the next big flood event was 64. So there's a couple of things I want to mention. One is that the river, one thing I've learned by being so much under the river is that it's not just a river of water. It's a river of sand, and it's a river of biologic materials like non-floating wood. There's so much wood on the bottom, and it almost weighs nothing. So any kind of cavity, any kind of boat or car with an open window underwater is going to completely fill up with wood, believe it or not, until the first big flood thing, and then the rocks and the more of the sand is really going to move into it. So I'm having to kind of looking at, you know, the car was there for 5 or 6 years before the 64 flood. And then that was the Christmas flood, which was a really different kind of flood. The ground was frozen, so it has its own signature. But right above that as I moved through it, I started seeing this layer of orange and black material. So fortunately, there's this guy who works at Cascade Locks, Tom. Everybody knows he's the captain of the steamship and mows the grass and everything. And I'm like, what could this be? He goes, there used to be a skeet shooting range just upstream of there in 1967 and 68. And I'm like, it's all clay pigeons, right? And it's all the ceramic. There's like a layer of ceramic in the stratigraphy, like we're saying. So now I'm like, okay, I know I'm close.
Yeah.
So once I got down there and then I located the car, and then, you know, the police did their thing in March. And then I ended up going back down to try to further excavate the car and to really prove it's the family and to resolve it. But then the car was full of wood and it was full of 1964 debris. And so I knew that it has a certain color to it. And I knew Bennett, and I knew this was all original stuff at that point.
Wow. And so here's where the case kind of takes a turn. So you find the car, you put together a plan to pull it out and recover it. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what happens?
Yeah, well, so I've been working with the sheriff department. So in order to get the SHPO and all these organizations on board with this, I got the sheriff to write me a letter for early on saying, you know, this is credible and we appreciate his help. So that really helped.
Yeah, you aren't a treasure hunter. You're motivated by really wanting to do this good service.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I had reasons to show that the area I'm digging in would not have funerary objects. It would not have, because just the physics of the way the pit works, the back of the pit, only really giant things end up back there.
Yeah.
Anything else is going to fall to the front. So I gave them the proof of the car. I had partial license plate. I had pictures of the car. Then they made a plan, and they didn't really include me in this plan, which was a little disappointing, but they paid a construction company, like an underwater construction company, to come with a crane and pull the car out. Well, I had found it more than 10 feet underground. So, and I had removed that overburden on the car, but the car had still been down there for almost 70 years. So they just decided to put like 10,000 pounds of force on it, on the frame. It was upside down. So they attached to the running gear. And after 2 days of work, they basically just yanked the frame off the car. Yeah, it was just super disappointing. I was very depressed for a few days, and I thought, you know, because it was my kind of my baby, and I had some ideas of how they could have done it better, but they're not archaeologists.
Yeah.
They're construction divers. That was March. Once the spring thaw went through, July 1st, I went back down there, and I found the car had been ruptured open by the force.
So now you're running against the clock, because now there could be erosion and other stuff impacting this scene, right?
You know, not so much as that. What had happened was when it got ruptured and pulled open, a lot of the hillside that I created actually went into it. And so now I'm having to like redig it out, but I know the strata enough to know.
Uh-huh.
And it took me basically a month to get all of the new debris out of it and to find my level of excavation again that I had seen, you know, that I knew was the 60s. So it took about a month of that. And then the first week of August, I knew I was back in 1964 debris with the wood. And then I started finding the actual some remains and some personal artifacts.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you're doing this, you're getting to the really sensitive part now. And so were you working with descendants or in coordination with them or just like in touch with them? Like, here's what's happening. I mean, I know the son survived. So presumably there's a lineage through him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he died in 2004. Donald was his name. And, you know, he's the one that was always kind of blamed for the family going missing. And I think the work I've done has shown that he was involved. But yes, he had a family. He has descendants. The Hood River Sheriff, I've been working very hand in glove with them because it's my project to a way, but you know, the moment I find human remains for the very first time, like first thing I did was call them and say, you know, how should I handle this? Because I have from SHPO, actually, I have an inadvertent discovery of human remains plan.
Yep.
And all that's very important. And we always, you know, try to like say, okay, I have this very obviously human thing. What do we do? And so, you know, we worked on that. And
you kind of knew, you know, that was the goal to recover the family. So you knew that was coming and you could prepare and have that plan in place with contingencies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's the plan that they put in is like in case you run across like mostly Indian or settler graves. But in this case, we knew we were headed toward human remains if my theories were correct. So, I just worked with the sheriff. It seemed the easiest, most direct thing. They were in touch with the descendants. There had already been some DNA testing happening when the car was first found. So hopefully that will all get buttoned up. I found a camera that says Ken Martin with his address scratched into the leather.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll be able to get images off the film.
Oh my gosh, yeah, wouldn't that be great?
Probably. They developed footage from like the Franklin expedition or one of those really, really old, not Franklin, but one of the really old Arctic expeditions.
I mean, if there's images, like it could have been a brand new role. Wouldn't that be like the worst news, right? but I mean, in my mind, I mean, it was in the car, in the case, in the camera. So whatever water first filled that camera would probably never got replaced. So any chemistry that happened in there, I think, would be very limited because it was never exposed to really current and the temperatures are very stable. So fingers crossed.
So now these family hopefully can be identified and laid to rest, and that's in somebody else's hands at the moment. But even just knowing the behavior of this vehicle as it entered the water and where it ended up, that probably sheds a lot of light onto this mystery and what happened to them. Or do you kind of have a theory now of what ultimately happened on that fateful day?
Yeah, I do. You know, at that point, there was just this big, probably 50 or 60 foot square concrete pad that was just right on the edge of the canal. And it's just a 90 degree drop with no buffer, or there was no railing. There was nothing to stop someone from driving in at that point. And so, you know, this was an early Ford automatic transmission, which, you know, I've since done research with somebody who has the exact same car who lives in Newburgh. And I went down there and he showed me that it's a complicated thing. Like, you don't just start it in park. You have to go from park to neutral to start the car. And then the car, if it's in drive, it will just sit there unless you put quite a bit of gas on it. Then it will start moving. So it's a really ambiguous system. So somehow I think they rolled in or went in the wrong gear. I mean, I've got theories, but who knows? I mean, no one really knows what happened that day.
Yeah.
But they went in there. And then, you know, the bottom line is that they had the diving technology been better at the time. And had they dove in the locks, but by the time the girls floated out, the car was already in the pit, which made it much harder to find.
Yeah. And this is a reminder that even though it's a cold case, it's not necessarily a crime. So you've been able to hopefully provide some closure for these family members that remain and hopefully kind of help these folks be laid to rest in a respectful way. So that's got to feel pretty good at the end of the day.
It does. And, you know, the other thing is I've received these cards from a lot of mostly women who are in their 70s who remember them going missing. And they would have been maybe the same age as the girls. And and I didn't realize, like, the tear of kind of that level of, you know, spiritual reality, that it's like they just always wondered what happened to them. And they always were a little bit terrified that if that happened to them, could it happen to somebody else?
And they
write me these cards with perfect penmanship and just say, like, thank you so much for doing this. You've really done, you know, an amazing service for giving us all closure. And it just means so much.
Oh, my gosh. And Archer, that wraps up this round of Underground History. But thank you so much for joining us today. I was just, like, enthralled this whole time. This is so fascinating. And keep up the good work. Let me know if you have another archaeological, you know, mystery to solve.
Keep me posted. Archaeology is such a fantastic thing. And I'm just in awe of people who choose that and get to do that their whole career. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, you've definitely applied a creative aspect to it. So, yeah. Well, that wraps up this round of Underground History and the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.